All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Morning. This is the matter of Adnich versus the Secretary. Counsel, will you please enter your appearances?
Yes, Your Honor. Maxwell Kinman, representing the appellant, Lynn Adnich.
David C. Wagner is co-counsel.
You'll argue?
That's correct.
Secretary.
For the Secretary, Your Honor, with me is Ken Walsh.
Thank you. Counsel, we have your request from your client to address the court. We've issued an order permitting her to speak to the court for 2 minutes. Would you proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. May it please the court, and with the court's permission, I would ask if the court allow Ms. Adnich to address.
Honorable judges, thank you for the opportunity to speak on my deceased husband's behalf, United States Air Force Vietnam veteran Donald E. Adnich, who died at the VA hospital in Cleveland, Ohio on August 5th, 2014. Please know that we were married for 45 years. Who in this courtroom has been married 45 years? Thank you. Then you know.
The record should show it was presiding Judge Greenberg who raised his hand.
Thank you, Judge Greenberg. You know the love of creating a marriage lasting that long, then suddenly is swept away and my heart is broken forever. My soulmate is gone, but never forgotten. It took 5.5 years to get a court date to tell my story. My husband died on August 5th, 2014 at 4 a.m. in the morning at the VA hospital in Cleveland, Ohio. We have 4 children, Louise Adnich, who was in high school, who we adopted from the Congo, Africa at the age of 8 years old. My husband, her father, never got to see her graduate from high school or go to her prom. Lyndon Adnich, my daughter, named after myself, Lynn, and my husband, Don, was a student at Bowling Green State University, the same college my husband went to, and he never got to see her graduate from Bowling Green State University. My 2 sons, Donald E. Adnich Jr. and Dion Adnich, lost their best advocate, their best friend, and best dad ever, who never missed a sports game or school event that they were in. I stand here before you today to make a wrong right, to address the devastating death of my husband, and ask you to pay all that's due and make an award in my favor. Since his death, Louise had to drop out of college to help support the family. I couldn't pay for her special tutoring at Notre Dame. She came from Africa and had some very special needs and requirements, which included private tutoring, and it had to stop because I couldn't afford it and I lost my husband's income. My husband survived the Vietnam War, yet he came home not to a ticker tape parade, but to be spat upon and yelled at by protesters of the war. He went to the VA hospital for dental implants, and he came home in a body bag. VA hospital put the final nail in his coffin, Agent Orange, in very substandard care at the VA hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, sent him to an early death. We will never celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary. He will never walk my daughters down the aisle when they get married, and I will never hold his hand again and be able to laugh and cry together. Instead, I visit a grave in Rittman, Ohio, at Ohio Western Reserve National Cemetery. I ask you today to vote in my favor. I'm here to make veterans aware that I stand behind them, and so should you. And I'm asking you to stand behind me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will consider the statement that you've made and the argument of counsel. Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Again, my name is Maxwell D. Kinman. I represent the appellant. I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal time. Your Honors, in this matter, we had a Vietnam veteran who passed away at the VA hospital in Cleveland, Ohio. In this matter as well, we've had a private medical opinion submitted by the appellant. And in that private medical opinion, the doctor clarified that the veteran's death was due to the procedure at the VA dental clinic and the gauze that was left in the veteran's mouth. On top of that, we actually have in this case an instance where the medical expert was present at the board hearing. As was noted during the board hearing by the veteran service officer, he had never seen that before in his long career. I imagine it is quite rare for a medical expert to actually appear during a board hearing. At the board hearing was the medical expert, was the appellant, and was her non-attorney veteran service officer. Also at that board hearing was the veterans law judge, who, as we all know, is an attorney. During the hearing, the doctor testified regarding the dental incident. He testified that the gauze caused aspiration. That is the record at page 31. He testified that because the veteran did not have a sphincter, this caused the gauze to go into his esophagus and eventually be pushed down into his stomach. Near the conclusion of those doctor's testimony, the veterans law judge had a colloquy with the doctor. They went back and forth, and this veterans law judge basically repeated the doctor's opinion, said that because the sphincter had been removed and the assertion is that because the veteran wasn't attended to properly, the gauze that went down his throat and was in his stomach, which caused aspiration, which then caused his heart attack and led to his death. That is the record at page 32, and those are the words of the veterans law judge. The doctor's response to that statement by the veterans law judge was yes. There were no further questions for the doctor. There was no follow-up questions asked by the veterans law judge. And at that point in time, everyone in that hearing would be under the understanding that the doctor had presented an opinion and that this attorney, the only attorney in the room, had no follow-up questions for that doctor.
Mr. Kimmon, could I ask a question? So your position is that there was some source of law that required the board member to do something at that point.
Yes.
Right?
That is
so cool. I've got two questions. One, what was the board member, in your view, required to do? And two, what source of law are you relying on to reach that conclusion?
Thank you, Judge Allen. It is our belief that the board member should have asked a follow-up question. The issue in this matter, as the board has narrowed it, is whether or not there was an additional disability due to the placement of the gauze. That is the only issue here. That was the only issue that was really before the board, was there any additional disability? And to find that, the board member had to suggest to the appellant that she present evidence showing that the gauze caused additional disability. The way to do that, and the clear way to do that, is to simply ask the doctor who's present at the hearing whether or not that gauze caused additional disability. And to answer your second question, the law behind that is the statutory and the regulations. We have 38 U.S.C. 7107, 38 CFR 3.103, Section D2.
Let me just stop you. What's the statute? What's the statute?
38 U.S.C. 7107.
You know, what's it say?
The quote of that statute, Your Honor, that is the overriding statute that was basically put in place to codify the Bryant decision of this court. And it says that, in short, there has to be, that the duties of the board hearing officer are to explain the issues and suggest the submission of evidence.
And to make themselves aware of the complete record before, during, or after the hearing.
That is correct.
Go ahead.
And so based on the...
By the way, I didn't mean... Are you satisfied with the answer? You've got Judge Allen.
Yeah, I think Mr. Kimmon might have been going to say other sources of law, but you're answering what I asked.
Sure. And then so from there, I would also point to this court's jurisprudence that applies that law. And we have Bryant versus Shinseki, 23 Vet App 488, one of the first... one of the first main cases that address the hearing officer's duties. And in that case, it says that the hearing officer must be engaged in the hearing process. Following that, we have Cook versus Snyder, which was affirmed via Cook versus Wilkie, where in that case, this court again found that the board functions as a fact finder similar to a trial court. And I think that language is appropriate, because if this was a trial court and it was a trial to a judge, And the judge was a fact finder, much like the veterans law judge is a fact finder during a board hearing. It is imperative upon that judge to get the facts and develop the evidence. And it's even more so.
It's a little different. A trial judge has got two advocates there presenting the evidence. It's not the trial judge's job to elicit the facts.
Yes.
This is different, though. That's your point.
It is different, and it's even more proclaimant, because this is a matter, it's not even like a criminal case where perhaps the defendant is pro se, where I think the duty falls upon the trial judge to help that pro se defendant. This is a situation where there is no counsel whatsoever. The only attorney in the room is the veterans law judge.
Well, isn't this also part of the broad duty to assist the veteran in perfecting their case?
It certainly is.
Required by statute?
Yes, Judge Greenberg, it certainly is. This whole line of cases and this whole thought process falls into the proclaimant duty to assist and the proclaimant setup of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Well, refresh my recollection about the record. Was there any contradictory medical evidence supplied by the secretary?
At the time of the board hearing, there was no contradictory evidence. There was evidence at that point in time, a written medical opinion from this private physician, and then there was the board hearing testimony.
Following the private physician is your...
Our position, yes.
Yeah. Was there any contradictory medical opinion from the secretary?
Only after the board hearing, then a VA medical opinion was produced. So the VA medical opinion was not of record at the time of the board hearing. It had not been completed. So after the board hearing is then when the VA completed a medical opinion on this matter.
What's your position on that?
Well, certainly we disagree with the medical opinion that was provided by the VA.
Well, what about the procedure of closing the hearing and then supplementing it apparently with a contrary medical opinion?
Yes,
your position is it's not fair, it's not right, it's not authorized, or is it all of those?
It would be all of those.
I'm confused. Isn't there a February 15 medical opinion? The hearing was in August of 2015. So the medical opinion is actually before the board, right?
You're right. I do apologize. So that medical opinion was before the board, but the VA medical, the private opinion was first. So the private written opinion was first.
Then it was responded to by the secretary. So this member of the Board of Veterans Appeals had both opinions before them?
Yes, I believe that is correct.
In fact, that's they gave more probative weight to the VA's, in the words of your brief, unfairly discounting the private medical opinion.
That is correct.
And they unfairly discounted it, because that's the focus of your argument in your brief, at least. There's not a lot of discussion of the statute or the regulation. It's that there's this unfair discounting. And that's the argument that the secretary responded to. Are you changing arguments now?
In the brief, the arguments were that the private medical opinion was unfairly discounted, but also that during the hearing, the veterans law judge did not suggest any evidence contrary to what was testified to. And then the third argument was that the VA medical opinion was inadequate because it was based on an accurate factual picture and the facts didn't connect with that actual opinion.
Does your position change if it, rather than the doctor actually testifying, he just submitted the one-page medical report saying the gauze caused death? If the veterans law judge is sitting there and having received that submission in documentary form, had not sought any follow-up, or is it just the fact that he was present there testifying that prompts the duty to inquire further, I guess, is what?
Yes, in this matter, I don't think it would matter whether or not the written medical opinion had been submitted. This doctor was there in person testifying.
So if a doctor, or if a veterans law judge receives a private medical exam, they have a duty to review it, and if it's lacking in some regard, they have a duty to seek supplementation of that private medical exam.
During a board hearing, not if the written opinion was just submitted, the veterans law judge doesn't have a duty to remand the case so that the private physician can adjust their opinion. But the difference here is that the private medical doctor was actually present.
Okay, so there is a distinction between the submitting a written one and the testimonial one.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you.
Yes.
And so, and just to, you know, tie that point up, we really don't have to reach any question like that, right? Because whether or not the board member would have some obligation in some other case with respect to only a written document submitted beforehand, it seems to me is quite different than this case where the board member is in the room with the, now it may not make a legal dispositive distinction, but we don't have to go that far.
That is correct. In this case, it is a very unique and narrow circumstance where there is a witness present at the board hearing discussing the question at hand. And even further, so in this hearing, the board member agreed with everything.
Right. What makes it unique, though? Is it just the fact that he's sitting there and it's a simple process for the veterans law judge to say, wait a second here, I hear what you're saying, but seems to me that you need to tell me why you think that or what you're basing that on. And it's just a few simple follow-up questions. Is that what makes it unique in a sense?
Yes, it does. And I think it'd be similar even if this wasn't a medical doctor. If this was a lay witness and perhaps the issue at hand was, did an incident occur in service? And the difference is if a lay witness submits a written statement and that written statement doesn't have any detail, then certainly the board, as the fact finder, can give that lower probative value. But if that same lay witness is at the actual board hearing and testifies briefly without any detail, I think it is imperative that the board member ask that lay witness to expand.
If the witness is sitting there and says, let's say it's a PTSD case, it's a lay witness to provide a buddy statement to lay out the stressor. And the witness simply testifies, he was in combat and saw a lot of bad stuff. Now, there's three possibilities from that statement. The witness knows that because they were there and saw the combat and saw the nasty stuff too. Another possibility is that it was hearsay, that the veteran told him that. And the third possibility is it's just conjecture, you know, I don't know what it is. And what probative value to give it depends on which of those it is, right?
That's correct.
If it's eyewitness, then that's strong evidence. If it's hearsay, by analogy, you know, we don't use hearsay rules, but there's a reason why hearsay is objectionable. It's unreliable. But some types of hearsay have circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness, so we admit it that. It has some reliability. But if you have no personal knowledge, you're just speculating, it's got pretty low probative weight. So it'd be incumbent upon the veterans law judge then to say, why do you say that?
That is correct. And that falls into the duty of the veterans law judge to suggest evidence necessary to substantiate the claim. And in a case of PTSD where the issue is whether the in-service incident actually happened, that duty is to suggest that this needs to be provided. We need to have detailed evidence of an actual in-service incident or event. And so that veterans law judge needs to ask that follow-up question as to, you say he was in combat, were you there? What happened? What do you personally know? And it's the same factual situation. It's just here it's a medical doctor, and the medical doctor is providing a medical opinion, and then the board is okay with the medical opinion during the hearing, and then turns around and says, well, the doctor didn't explain the rationale, didn't explain this issue. It's the same background that the veterans law judge has that duty to suggest the evidence, and if the evidence, the missing piece of evidence was the cause of additional disability, which was the only argument here, that's the missing piece. Did this gauze that was left in the veteran's esophagus that he swallowed, did that cause an additional disability? That's the question here. The veterans law judge needed to suggest to the appellant during the board hearing, we need evidence that this caused additional disability. Oh, by the way, you have a medical doctor here available today to talk to me and explain why this caused the additional disability. And so that's what we're seeking, and it's the same whether it's a medical doctor who's doing it or a lay witness that's doing it.
Why is the secretary argues that this requires pre-adjudication, that the veterans law judge is then pre-adjudicating the case. What's your response to that?
This is not a pre-adjudication. A pre-adjudication would be, back to our PTSD example, if during the hearing the lay witness presented evidence and the lay witness, the veterans law judge asked follow-up questions, then the lay witness said, I was there on this ship with him, or I was there in country, we served in this unit, and the veterans law judge takes that information. Then to adjudicate that claim, the veterans law judge realizes that information was incorrect or that information was false. That's when the adjudication comes into. Same in this case. If this medical doctor provided an opinion as to why the gauze caused an additional disability, and then there was other medical evidence that showed that it did not, either a VA opinion or treatise evidence or some other underlying factor, that's then the adjudication phase. The role of the board hearing is the fact-finding phase. So we were not asking the veterans law judge to make an adjudication as to whether or not this was malpractice or whether or not this was reasonably foreseeable. The only duty of the veterans law judge was to gather the proper facts, and the perfect time to do so was at that board hearing when the doctor was there. Later on, the veterans law judge is perfectly fine to then question those facts and to adjudicate those facts and to find that some are more or less probative.
Weigh them against the other examination. What if the veterans law judge is sitting there and decides, based on the testimony of this witness, whether medical or lay, that there's credibility issues?
That is certainly within the purview.
With the witness's testimony.
Yeah, that is certainly within the purview of the veterans law
judge. They have a duty then to inquire about those or point out those issues that are raising credibility concerns so that they can be remedied?
I don't believe so that they have a duty to address credibility concerns. They would have the duty, again.
Well, how about just pointing out, your testimony is inconsistent with this other piece of evidence I have in front of me. What do you have to say about that?
I would like them to do that. I think that would make the system run a lot more.
Does the law, the sources of authority that you cite, require that?
I do not believe that they do require that. They don't. I think that would get into pre-adjudicating the claim, because then the veterans law judge would be making the decision as to what is credible.
But isn't it the same? So they get the board decision. The board decision says, we found that witness incredible. They discount the testimony. Isn't that the same argument you're making? Is that, well, that's not fair. You should have told me at the hearing that you were going to discount the testimony. And now here I find, when I read the board decision, that I now know you needed more.
I think that would be a proper view as to the duties of the veterans law judge, but I don't think we need to go quite that far in this case, because here there's no determination that the medical expert was prejudiced or was making an incorrect analysis. In this case that we have before us today, it was simply there was no questions asked, and later on there was not a determination of credibility or something that could be cured. It was just simply, I don't have enough information to make the decision.
We'll take that up on your rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the secretary, please.
Judge Greenberg, and may it please the court. The court should affirm the May 2018 board decision that denied entitlement to compensation under Section 1151. When the board arrived at this determination, it fulfilled the duties of the hearing officer under 3.103C2. So appellant's argument is not supported by precedent. In Bryant, before the court described what the hearing officer must do, it described what the hearing officer is not required to do. It first held that the board member is not required to pre-adjudicate the claim at the hearing or assess the credibility and probative value of the record evidence.
So let me ask you this. Bryant didn't say this affirmatively, but you would agree with me, wouldn't you, that the board member has an obligation not to pull the wool over somebody's eyes at the hearing, right? In other words, Bryant didn't say this, but the board member can't mislead the veteran, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So, you know, it's funny. I'm going back through the hearing transcript this morning, actually. It struck me that this isn't a case just about a board member not asking a follow-up question like, why? One word, right? This is a case in which the board member repeatedly said, I believe I understand your testimony. And she repeats this and repeats it again. What would a normal person think? Would they think, yeah, I understand your testimony and it has absolutely no basis? No. Wouldn't they think, I understand what you're saying, not that I don't have enough information from what you're saying? So I actually think that this case may be a case of actual affirmative misrepresentation.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. So the doctor elaborated on his bare conclusion in his written opinion at the hearing. And his hearing testimony was inconsistent at first. First, he stated that...
No. What is your understanding? If I said to you today, as a judge, I understand your argument, right? Would you then say to your co-counsel, oh my God, we got a problem with Judge Allen because he said, I understand, and that could mean maybe I understand that you have no support for your argument, right? No, you'd say, oh, Judge Allen understands my argument. Why here wouldn't the doctor and the representative and the appellant think when the board member says, I understand, not that they're gonna win, but that at least that evidence isn't, as the board later says, something that I'm going to discount because you didn't explain enough. Why wouldn't a normal person simply think that when the board member repeatedly says, I understand your testimony, that there isn't some sort of fatal flaw in the testimony?
Your Honor, the VLJ said, let me make sure I understand your testimony. And she asked the doctor if that was correct. He said, yes. So that's a neutral statement. She's not indicating whether she believes it or disbelieves it or finds it convincing or unconvincing. She is simply making a neutral statement. I understand your testimony. So.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead with your argument. This is a silly thing for the secretary to be fighting with, that an adjudicator can listen to something, think it isn't supported by something, and doesn't have an obligation to say why. That's it. It's one question. It's why. So you can explain, but I do not buy this at all.
So, Your Honor, the court has been clear that the duty to suggest evidence under 3.1 and 3C2, and that's the issue here, the duty to suggest the submission of evidence that is potentially favorable to client. It's not at issue is the the board member's obligation to fully explain the issues that are outstanding. It's when the record is missing any evidence on an issue material to substantiating the claim, or when the testimony at the hearing raises an issue for which there is no evidence of record. So that regulation in this court's precedent, Brian, doesn't speak to the quality or strength of the evidence that's presented.
So if, in fact, then in this case, the claimant was there with, the appellant was there with her lawyer, or her VSO representative, and didn't submit anything that was about the additional, the presence of an additional disability, right? Then the board member would be required to say, you should know that in order to establish this claim, you have to have evidence of the incurrence of an additional disability under Bryant, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, but yet perversely, when she tries to do that and the veterans law judge listens to it and says, boy, this guy's conclusory, I can't figure out why he thinks that way, he doesn't have to say anything, or she in this case, the board member doesn't have to say anything.
She went right up to the line of what a board member is required to do at the hearing under the regulation.
So before you go on and explain, I'd like a yes or no answer. In your view, if there was no evidence, the board member would be under Bryant required to say, you need to submit some evidence on this point, right? You said yes. So, but yet, if the claimant tries to do that at the hearing and presents facially deficient evidence, the board member can just sit there like a potted plant and say nothing.
So,
I hate to do this to you. That is a yes or no question. Is that your position? Okay, that is your position.
If you want a simple yes or no answer.
You can explain now, but I want out on the record quite clearly then that in the face of evidence that later is said to be something that I can discount because it has no backup, because the person tried to present it, your view is that even though in silence the board member would have an affirmative obligation to say something, when the person tries and fails, they don't have to say a word.
So, Your Honor, there's a difference between pre-adjudication and asking follow-up questions. And here would be a fine line, because the questions would probe the weakness and the rationale, which would be the first step to weighing the evidence. And this is during the developmental phase of the case. It's not the adjudicatory phase of the case. So here it's about gathering evidence and substantiating the claim. And at the time of the board hearing, there was the November 2014 opinion by Dr. Dar, and there was the February 2015 VA opinion. So the record was substantially complete. So the board member was not obligated under precedent, under the regulation, to probe Dr. Dar at all.
I don't think that Judge Allen's suggesting that a probing is required. It strikes me that, and maybe there is a difference between a lay witness who testifies and has gaps in their testimony, but here you've got an expert. And if an expert were testifying in U.S. District Court, we wouldn't let them just come in and testify as to their opinion. We'd want to know their expertise. We'd want to know their the basis for their opinion. Our case law says the probative value of a examination comes from the rationale underlying the conclusion. So the veterans law judge is sitting there and hears a conclusion without a rationale, and it doesn't strike me as too probing to say, what's your rationale, or why do you think that?
So, Your Honor, if I may, I respectfully disagree. So,
what would you disagree with?
This is not
all of it.
This is not a trial. This is a non-adversarial. It's still non-adversarial at this point.
But even that's, to me, that means even more so. Does the veterans law judge have the obligation to say, gee, I know that an opinion without a rationale carries little probative weight. What's the rationale?
There's no difference in the regulation between an ordinary lay witness and an expert medical witness that appears before the board member at a board hearing. And Dr. Dar did clarify his written opinion at the board hearing. So in his written opinion, he just said, the surgical gauze caused the veteran's death. And he elaborated at the board hearing that it caused the veteran's death because it was, the gauze was left in the mouth, it was swallowed, and he swallowed into his stomach, and then that caused the veteran's death.
So what more do you need?
Who's the doctor you're quoting from?
That's his
veteran's doctor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. What did the secretary's doctor say? In a written report?
In the written report, the secretary's expert witness said it is not like...
Is it an MD?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
It's a primary care physician. So it's not likely that the veteran swallowing the gauze, subsequent impaction in the esophagus, followed by its pushing into the veteran's stomach, resulted in any additional disability. And that's record at 2976. And then he proceeded to elaborate on that.
So was he there at the hearing?
No, Your Honor.
But the doctor for the veteran was?
Yes, Your Honor.
Seems to me, based upon what I've just heard from Judge Allen and Judge Falvey, we've got a situation where, is it consistent with the intent of Congress, let alone the Secretary's regulation, to just let it go with that, or to even go further and delude the veteran or the veteran's representative into thinking that the member of the board understood what was being presented and was inclined toward a favorable opinion toward the veteran? In other words, even assuming this is a net opinion situation, isn't it the obligation of the member of the board to interrogate both witnesses or all witnesses so that there's a complete record that we ultimately have to review and interpret the factual determinations?
Well,
what's the harm in the member of the board saying to the veteran's doctor, look, it sounds like a net opinion. You have to be more specific.
So interrogation is not non-adversarial, Your Honor. So she would only be obligated to interrogate or question Dr. Dar if there was no evidence on file about the disability. That is
Are you saying that the member of the board, that's how I'm characterizing this adjudicator, in a non-adversary proceeding, doesn't have an obligation to indicate to the veteran, look, I just don't believe your doctor, or I don't believe your doctor has given me enough information to rule in your favor. Why don't you present some more question of your doctor, or why don't you tell me why I shouldn't rely on the written opinion of the secretary's doctor?
Well,
don't you think that's more consistent with the duty to assist?
Your Honor, that would be the role for the board member at the adjudicatory phase to assess the weakness of the opinion, not at the board hearing.
No, but the witnesses are there. This is a big, to me, this sounds like a big deal. To me, this sounds like it's more a matter of reversal rather than possible remand. This is a substantial legal question. What is the obligation of the person who, practically speaking, is the only adjudicator the veteran is ever going to see in the vast majority of cases?
Your Honor, that is not the system that VA has developed.
So you could, in my hypothetical, the veterans law judge is sitting, she hears the witness, she says in her head, that is the most conclusory medical opinion I have ever heard. She can just say absolutely nothing, say, thank you, I understand your testimony, and that's consistent with the non-adversarial proclaimant system. I mean, I hate to be as direct with you, but I truly am baffled how that could possibly be the case.
Yes, if Your Honor, if you're looking for a simple yes or no answer, yes.
So that's fine. They can say, yep, I know. Or how about this? What if the doctor used a word that the veterans law judge didn't understand? Okay? Doctor uses a word, shorthand for something. And the veterans law judge thinks to herself, This could be a good opinion if I understood what that word means. But I'm just going to sit here and not say, what does that word mean? And then later writes an opinion that says, used a word I didn't understand. And that's totally fine. The person doesn't have to say, I don't understand what you're telling me.
There's a reason why Congress kept this a non-adversarial proceeding, to make sure that presumably well-trained, consistently trained members of the board give the veteran A, a fair shake, and B, the benefit of the doubt. Is that what we have here?
The benefit of the doubt would apply at the adjudicatory phase, Your Honor. So here during the...
What do you mean the adjudicatory phase?
So there's a, if you will, there's a developmental phase where we are assisting the claimant in developing the claim.
Yeah, and then it gets to the board, which is, as a matter of practice, is an individual member of the board is assigned to the hearing, is obligated under the statute to make themselves fully aware of the file before they even go into the hearing. There's no question about that. And secondly, at the hearing, to interrogate the witnesses to satisfy themselves that there's a complete record upon which they can make a determination consistent with the statutory and regulatory scheme.
So, Your Honor, the hearing...
So they've got to do something besides, as Judge Allen says, sit there as a potted palm.
So, Your Honor, the hearing is significant. It is the place where we assist claimants by explaining the outstanding issues and allowing the claimant to present testimony.
And what did she do here that complies with that standard?
So the board member permitted Dr. Dar to testify. But there's no allegation that she failed to explain the outstanding issues. There is the allegation that she failed to fulfill her duty to suggest the submission of overlooked evidence. That would be advantageous to the claim. But here the case was developed. There were two opinions of record.
Go ahead. Keep going. If you have anything further to say.
I don't have anything else to say.
I've got a few more questions. Yes. If the veteran's spouse testified instead of Dr. Dar and said, my doctor wrote us a letter saying that the surgery caused his death, you'd agree that the board member needs to say, if you'd like to submit that letter, I'll keep the record open, and you may do so, right?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
So instead of the veteran's spouse, the doctor testifies and says, I wrote a letter in which I concluded that the veteran's death was caused by the surgery. You'd do the same thing, right? Submit that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if the doctor testifies and says, I'm here today, rather than writing a letter, I'm here today to say his death was caused by the surgery. You'd accept that testimony, but you wouldn't say, why do you say that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
They have no duty to do that.
Correct.
And that's because asking that question would be a pre-adjudication.
Correct, Your Honor.
What's pre-adjudication?
Pre-adjudication will be the prematurely evaluation, weighing the value and the credibility of the evidence.
Pre-adjudication sounds to me like you've got the file in front of you before we ever have a hearing. You come to a conclusion based upon that. You state it in the reasoning behind the determination and pay no attention to what went on before you in the hearing. Isn't that what the forbidden pre-adjudication is intended to deal with or remedy? You're supposed to sit there with an open mind as a member of the board, had the case presented to you. It's non-adversary.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. The board member is supposed to sit there with an open mind and to receive the testimony.
But beyond open mind, investigate what's in the file beforehand.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. The case law has made it clear that the board member has to be familiar with the outstanding issues.
So that they can then pursue questions to help the veteran perfect the file or perfect the claim.
They're supposed to be familiar with the file to the extent that it reveals the issues that needed to be, the outstanding issues that needed to be explained to the claimant, or that reveals evidence that is missing in the statute of the claim.
I don't think either of you briefed or discussed the Savage case. I'm wondering if that provides some support for your position.
Yes, Your Honor, it does. So under Savage, and 3 years later, the court explained in Carter that there is a very limited duty by VA to obtain clarification from a private physician. So first, the missing information has to be objective and factual. So in the Savage case, it was whether the private audiologist used the Maryland CNC examination. And then in Carter, the court elaborated that the duty is limited to where there is only the private medical opinion of record. So that wouldn't apply here, because the issue is the adequacy of Dr. Dar's rationale, which is not a simple yes or no question. And there is also a VA examination.
But does the rule from Savage apply necessarily to, yes, makes perfect sense. Most of this is done on paper. And so Savage adopts a rule that says the board member or the board or the RO doesn't have to follow up on written medical evidence and say, well, no, you know, tell me more, because if you told me more, I might balance this differently against other evidence of record, because the burden on VA would be great if we said that whenever you find the rationale of a private opinion not sufficient, you have to follow up, right? But isn't it just distinctly different when the person is sitting in front of you and all you need to do is say, why do you think that?
No, Your Honor, it is not, because under the regulation, the board member only has to suggest the submission of potentially favorable evidence that is missing. So here, there was no obligation on behalf of the board member to question Dr. Darden's rationale to ensure the clarity and completeness of the record.
Okay.
So if Your Honors have no more questions, the Secretary respectfully asks you to affirm the board's decision.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court.
What's going to happen here if we remand? What are you going to do?
On remand, the doctor would submit a clarifying, detailed medical opinion that would satisfy the adequate rationale. I mean, the hope would be to avoid that and to avoid any more evidence being submitted. And to support that, I would ask the court to look at the factual situation as well. The facts clearly supported the private medical opinion. This gentleman was, for 2 years prior to his dental surgery, not having any problems. He was eating solids and liquids for the past 2 years. He had what was called silent aspiration, but had no issues. After his dental procedure, the very next day, he went into the urgent care. That's when he could not swallow, could not drink anything, could not even swallow his own saliva. He was in such good health before this, he was planning a cruise to Puerto Rico. That's the record of 1875. So initially, when these problems developed, the family was concerned as to, can his medical care continue into Puerto Rico? Again, the same day, after he goes to the urgency care, he submits to the VA medical hospital. Later that night, he again can't tolerate foods, can't drink, can't eat. As the record continues, They have to, again, go through his esophagus, and at that point in time, no one knows that there's gauze in the esophagus. So when they complete the EJD, they push down the impacted food because all they can see is food stuck. They push that into the stomach. He continues to have problems, continued his aspirations, continues not being able to eat liquid or solid foods. On February 26, record of 1875, he completes a barium swallow test. That shows he's aspirating. The barium liquid that he's swallowing is actually going into his lungs. February 27th, his condition is worsening. They attempt to put in a PEG tube. He obviously hasn't eaten in 6 days. He's given vitamins. His health is deteriorating. He's tachycardic. He's febrile, acutely hypoxic. He's developing pneumonia.
Where's all this coming from?
This is from the record. That specific one is record 1853 from February.
And this record was made before your doctor testified at the hearing?
These dates were from before the testimony,
yes. Yeah.
This was all part of the medical record at the hearing. So he clearly, before this incident at the dental...
So you're swinging for the fences here now, right? You're seeking a reversal and arguing that there needs to be nothing further below. There still has to be a weighing of the two, right? And we're not going to... We're not here to weigh two examinations against each other.
But when the factual situation, the factual picture, the only factual evidence of the record supports the private medical opinion, I think it is in this court's purview to avoid further time, energy, resources.
Right. So my colleague, my esteemed colleague, my athletic colleague said you were swinging for the fences. But actually, there are two possible remedies that you're seeking. One is a remand, and I asked you about that. What more has to be done by the board if we were to merely remand it as opposed to reverse it and order the secretary to enter judgment in favor of the veteran on the basis of the record made below, erroneously decided by the board and presented to us?
So what more the board would have to do, I think the board's requirements would be to either allow an additional board hearing. I think that would be part of the remand orders. And additionally, to explain that the evidence needed, what was missing here was the...
But here's what I'm getting at. You're here. You've come all the way here. And if you go back on a remand, maybe that's the way it'll be. Maybe you won't win at all. I can't speak for my colleagues. We're here to listen and then make our decision based upon what we've heard and what we've read and the law we consider and the facts. But assuming that it's remanded, does this mean that the secretary gets to go out and get another doctor to cross the T's and dot the I's that hadn't been crossed or dotted before?
Certainly.
Does that mean that you have to go out and get another doctor to be more explicit about the cause of disability here?
Certainly the appellant's position is that she has done everything needed.
Exactly.
She has presented the doctor to a board hearing.
Well, isn't that an argument then that there's been no prejudice here? But that maybe it's a different error. There's no prejudice in not asking the follow-up questions because you're saying the rationale is all there. If the rationale is all there and the board member erred, I guess, in reasons or bases or something else, but
well, clearly
it seems to be that's what you're saying, is that the rationale is all there. There's nothing more that needs to be done.
That is correct, but if the board finds opposite, then there's prejudice. It is prejudicial. And
I appreciate trying to hit the home run. Definitely when Judge Greenberg was talking about the athletic member of the group, it was definitely Judge Falvey, not me. But as my kids will tell you, but be careful about trying to swing so far because you might pull a muscle, okay? Because Judge Falvey is telling you, I'm telling you, if you take the position you're taking now, then you will likely lose because the error is not prejudicial. Okay? Because if the opinion itself is fine, good enough for us to make a ruling, then the fact that the board member didn't say why at the hearing is not prejudicial. So just take that into account.
Understandable.
Okay?
And certainly to get back to Judge Greenberg's response of his responsive question is there are things that can happen on a remand here that can fix the record.
And you're content with that? A remand?
The appellant is
content. In other words, you're content to go for the single or the double to continue this hideous analogy activity rather than swinging for the fences.
I think on baseball, if you get on base, that helps your team.
And it's conceivable, perhaps. I'm just spitballing a different type of ball here, perhaps the remand is for the board to give you the opportunity to rehabilitate your exam, but you know, perhaps there have been some other situations where we've said the secretary can't develop further evidence. I mean, hypothetically, that's fine, right? And let me just ask you one other question. I assume you'd take a call from the secretary if after this oral argument the secretary might see the writing on the wall. Right? And so maybe I just throw that out there. So thank you.
What's involved here in terms of money?
Not much, Your Honor. And that's probably the most striking thing about this case is realistically the appellant has been granted DIC benefits. So she not even related to the aspiration and the gauze and all that. So realistically, the issue is the benefits that were due to the appellant from the date of the dental injury of February 2014 until the date of his death of August 2014. So realistically, we're looking at four or five month period of additional benefits. It's not going to change the Treasury's purse or the Secretary's purse in any wide-ranging goal, but it is still important to the appellant, and it's very important to her.
All right, anything else?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will reserve opinion, and we will, as is our custom, come down and greet counsel.
All rise.